Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On this week's program, we explore the strategies for living with someone with Alzheimer's disease and dementia and what caregivers need to know.
If feeding becomes an issue, as it does for people as the disease progresses, hand feeding. It doesn't have to be fast. Go slow. This could be a time, actually, a really positive interaction between a loved one and their caregiver. It's a way to care for somebody and show your love.
Plus, we learn all we can about dealing with your aching back.
It's been a real mystery what differentiates those people who maybe have a disc herniation and don't have pain from the person who has that disc herniation and does have pain. It's really a complex question that we unfortunately haven't quite figured out yet.
We'll also hear a selection from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, if you've ever been heard to say, "Oh, my aching back," you'll find out all that you need to know. But first, strategies for living with someone with dementia. Today, about 15 million people care for a loved one with Alzheimer's in the United States, and many caregivers find their role difficult and yet rewarding. But knowing what to expect and preparing for the challenges can help people with Alzheimer's and other dementias live better. Here with more on just how to do that is Dr. Andrea Berg. She's assistant professor of medicine specializing in geriatrics at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Berg. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin by first trying to define for our listeners, what is dementia and how does that differ, if at all, from Alzheimer's disease?
So dementia is a general term. It's used for loss of cognitive functioning, things like thinking, memory, reasoning, to such an extent that it would interfere with someone's ability to perform daily activities. Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia among older adults.
And so when you say, so basically they're often used interchangeably these days, but the types of characteristics that you might have if you have Alzheimer's, do they vary very much from a dementia caused by something other than Alzheimer's?
Yes, there's other types of Alzheimer's, frontotemporal disorders, dementia with Parkinson's or Lewy body. But Alzheimer's, typically the pattern, realizing that it's individualized in each individual, but typically starts, it's a slowly progressive disease, and initially primarily affecting short-term memory, and later on extending into other parts of cognition like language, reasoning, judgment.
We're going to talk about some of the problems that arise around this. So when we use the two for at least for today's discussion, a lot of the characteristics that we'll be talking about would be seen really all through that world of dementia.
Yes, it's a spectrum. It's a progressive disorder, and absolutely, yes.
So one of the things that seems to come to mind initially is one of the greatest interruptions in the person's functioning is their ability to communicate. And as you said, it happens slowly, and you can see changes over time, and clearly it's an individual thing. But what are the kinds of things that you generally see when someone's beginning to have or has problems in communicating? What are the typical symptoms?
Well, as we mentioned, initially it's short-term memory is the area of the brain that's first affected and predominantly affected in the early stages. And so what you might see in a person or in oneself is a difficult time remembering recent events or rapidly forgetting things that are told to you.
Or, for example, they might have trouble finding a word.
definitely. That could be a language part with word finding difficulties or becoming quite repetitive. Families might notice somebody is being repetitive or unable to maintain focus.
And I know a lot of people, at least in my age range, will say, oh, I must be losing it because I have trouble with word finding. That's a natural part of aging, but when it becomes more extreme, for example, if you lose your train of thought completely, you begin speaking off on a topic, and then you've kind of been lost in your thought pattern repeatedly, that's more common. So what do you recommend to your patients and to the people surrounding them, the caregivers, the loved ones, whatever term you want to use? What do you recommend as the best way to cope with these kinds of communication difficulties?
For the patient themselves, in the early stages, if this is truly an early dementia and not some other form of memory loss that's not a dementia, in the early stages, lists might help, or organizing oneself, giving verbal cues or reminders are very helpful in keeping on track and maintaining focus. We promote very much physical activity, cognitive engagement, social engagement to maintain a vibrant and robust health across
the spectrum.
But
one of the things that strikes me is, and I think people often do this in terms of the people surrounding people with a communication difficulty or particular subsequent to dementia, is that a person may say something, the patient may say something, or the individual may say something, and there's an attempt to correct what they've said. And I think what I've been seeing is, isn't it important rather to be supportive and not necessarily have to make the point that that person misstated something or forgot something?
Yeah, we have a mantra that we use a lot in our clinic and recommend people say, just remember, never correct, just redirect. And that comes in many different forms. Typically when you correct somebody, it sort of throws them on their heels and makes them lose their confidence a little bit more. Typically, people are already a little bit self-conscious about losing memory and are aware to some degree in the earlier stages. So redirecting into other areas, changing the topic, avoiding a conflict or a problem before you actually get into it.
So you would kind of avoid arguing, perhaps offer a guess as to what they were trying to say, maybe limit the distractions in the environment perhaps, or even focus on how they're feeling, perhaps on then rather the concept.
Yeah, kind of absolutely. For example, a common thing in the more moderate to advanced stages are people can perseverate on a concept that I want to go home, even if they might be in their home. But they're referencing a different time because their time frame might be skewed. And so instead of correcting them, which is usually a pretty futile effort, focusing in on that concept of home and engaging them on that concept of home. What does that concept mean? What is so appealing about being home? Acknowledging those feelings and validating them can kind of drive it into a different area as opposed to a conflict of correcting them on where they actually might be located in that moment.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen along with geriatrician Dr. Andrea Berg. And we're talking about strategies for living with someone with Alzheimer's disease. Another thing that really kind of becomes a major focus early on and in this whole world of living with people with dementia is this notion of driving. When you first start to notice that someone is not got their full faculties, obviously there's a great concern around their continuing to drive. What do you begin to recommend to your patients and their families as to the best way to approach that?
This is a really hot topic, it has a lot of real implications for people. I usually give the advice to family members who approach me with concerns about loved one and their driving, that I generally say, if you are concerned about your children or your grandchildren driving independently in the car with your loved one, then this is an issue and this is a problem.
So it's
for
kind
us.
Of a litmus test.
That is our litmus test.
And then what do you recommend doing? I mean, I've heard things like having a conversation with the individual, starting the process of acknowledging that perhaps it's not a great idea. I mean, how do you begin to reach someone on that very difficult, because it's such a sign of loss of independence?
Absolutely. Well, like everything, this is going to have to be individualized to the person. But sometimes you can also avoid a conflict by taking away the need for driving. That's one way to start. And some people don't really want to drive, and it gets them off the hook without engaging in a conflict. So seeing if you can kind of put fillers in, different people driving them, so it just sort of obviates the need to drive in the first place. That's definitely the first place to start. That's our low-lying fruit.
Does it ever work to appeal to a person's sense of responsibility, do you think, even at that early phase of saying that, you know, your reflexes may not be quite as good as they've been, your vision may not be quite as strong as it's been, we don't want you to hurt yourself or anyone else. Does that tend to work as well?
Sometimes it does, absolutely, because cognition is not the only part that comes into play with safe driving. There is a functional component, a dexterity, visual acuity, sensory impairments or functional limitations. They could all impair somebody's ability. So sometimes focusing on some of those less charged things as opposed to the cognitive deficits. People are very reasonable, often to a sense of community well-being and not driving.
Is it helpful to get other people involved in the conversation, whether it be you as the physician involved or another objective third party or other family members? Does that usually help?
We have a lot of discussions in the clinic about driving. We talk about things like, you know, functional assessments and cognitive implications of driving. But additionally, if it's a little artificial to give a driving evaluation in the clinic. Some of our testings, we can kind of extrapolate and think that there might be some concerns and red flags, but there also are road-based evaluations that can be done to really get a better sense of how people are performing behind the wheel. That can be done through the DMV or through AAA or different driving schools.
So I know in this community, it does really present a great challenge, because we don't have the kind of infrastructure in terms of public transportation, especially in some of the more rural areas. So it is really a problem and does require people to step up surrounding someone who is all of a sudden not able to drive themselves.
Yes, it has real implications on somebody's ability to function. Sometimes you have to get creative in the later stages of the illness if there's real safety implications and somebody is resistant or if they forget that they don't drive any longer. Removing access to a vehicle out of
taking
sight, out of mind, removing the car from the premises altogether, removing spark plugs, disabling the vehicle. These are all strategies that people have employed. Making sure the spare sets are not available around the house and that they're well accounted for.
And there are alternative, as I said, that we may not have the depth of infrastructure. Some communities have started Friends in Service helping organizations where they actually have volunteers who will drive senior citizens and people obviously who are having some dementia issues to various appointments and that kind of thing. And we have call a bus. I mean, there are alternatives, but maybe not as many as there might be in a bigger kind of city with, you know, other forms of public transportation.
Absolutely. We have such a huge catchment that it's hard to speak in specifics. I think on the whole, your local area office for aging would be a great resource to know in your county or where you're located specifically, what are some of those potential options?
Let's talk about emotions, because obviously emotions are really kind of a central part of this whole experience, both for the caregiver, family members, but also obviously for the individual who's starting to have some cognitive failing. And depression comes up as a major consideration, a major concern. And what keeps coming up is, how does one distinguish between what we call clinical depression and some aspects of dementia? What are some of the distinctions or the differences?
There are so many overlaps. You're absolutely right. And it could be very difficult to discern what could be primarily a depression, an organic depression, versus part of the dementia syndrome. So some of the similarities and some of the ways we can parcel it out. If somebody had a longstanding history of anxiety and depression, we're going to still see that manifested with dementia. Dementia won't take that away.
So history could help you to perhaps parse out what's going on with the individual at that moment in time.
Certainly. It definitely is something that we screen for heavily, looking as there's sometimes behavioral changes with dementia. And so are some of these changes that we're seeing part of the dementia syndrome with a longstanding history of depressive symptomology? I'd be more inclined to think this might be responsive to treating the depression.
So before we get there in terms of treatment, what are the kinds of things that you see? So the kinds of the characteristics that you might see, something like apathy, mm-hmm. for example, social withdrawal, isolation, even impaired thinking. I mean, do those all go with what would be a classical clinical depression?
Right.
But they also go with...
In the absence of a dementia, if I was screening for somebody for a depression, some concerning flags would be if somebody was showing a loss of interest in things that they previously were very passionate about or interested in, or were with more socially withdrawn or introverted where they weren't before. Certainly, you know, changes in sleep patterns or eating patterns, changes in weight that were unintentional. Those are all things that we think of: depressed mood, thoughts of self-harm, hopelessness.
Those are more characteristic of a so-called clinical depression. Let me ask you to hold that thought. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more Upstate's HealthLink on Air, along with Dr. Andrea Berg, and we're going to be talking more about dementia and how people surrounding people with dementia can cope. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with geriatrician Dr. Andrea Berg. We're talking about strategies for living with someone with Alzheimer's disease. And just before the break, we were talking about depression. Let's get back to that. What do you do with your patients, or what do you recommend to your to the family of patients who have a loved one who has some dementia issues and showing some of these characteristics that look like depression? How do you tease out the diagnosis, and then what do you recommend be done?
So as we talked about, there's a lot of overlapping symptoms. If I think that there is a case that there actually is a reactive depression or just an organic depression at play as well, often we will try treating that with medications.
Like an antidepressant?
Exactly. Certainly, we can give it a good trial period. If it really is more part of the dementia syndrome, that the loss of activities or interests is more reflective of a progressive neurodegeneration, then it's not going to really respond to antidepressants, and in time we might taper them off. Sometimes we do try to see, and often there is a reactive depression, understandably so.
Reactive meaning reactive to their loss of cognitive ability. So in other words, they are self-aware enough to realize I'm losing my abilities, and therefore they become depressed.
In the early stages, certainly.
So you do find that treatment with things like SSRIs can really mitigate that, can help?
They can be very helpful in some cases. In certain situations, it's not, and they shouldn't be forever medications for everybody. Every medication comes with its own potential side effects.
Right, and there are drug-drug interactions one might worry about, because with some people with some cognitive impairment might be on some other medications like an Aricept type drug or something of that nature. Is there a problem with that, with there being...
Those two are written together reasonably well. I think the important part is that with every new drug comes its own set of issues, potential side effects for the individual, or just the pill burden of taking another medication and the logistics of having to make sure that medication is being taken appropriately.
So basically, it's going to be very much an individual on a case-by-case basis, a lot of the things you're saying. And it sounds like there's got to be a very close relationship then with someone like a geriatrician or your primary care physician who can begin to kind of try to parse this out and even be willing to make changes.
Absolutely.
As you move along,
yeah,
because it's hard to really know full well or clearly or definitively that symptoms that you're seeing are being caused by a specific thing.
Yes, absolutely. It's difficult. Right now, where we are with dementia care, our offerings in the area of medicines is really just symptom management. Even medications like donepezil or Aricept that you referenced earlier, those are really better described as symptom management medications. They're not disease modifying, meaning that they really won't change the course of the illness itself. The progression will happen. It just sort of masks the effects for a while artificially, but it doesn't actually change the process that's going on. So it's all really symptom management, and it has to be dynamic and individualized.
So it has to be willing to change, mm-hmm, and respond to kind of what you're seeing in individual patient. Let's talk a little bit about some of the difficult behaviors that also arise, which cause a lot of difficulty for people. Things, for example, like agitation or wandering or paranoia.
Yeah.
Let's just start with agitation. When someone's very agitated, what's the best methodology? Again, is that something you're going to throw a pill at, or are there some non-medication type ways of coping with that?
The first way is always to start with the non-medication ways. Our first line is always to try to take a step back and look at the big picture and see what might be causing some of these behavioral changes. Is it really a dementia? Is it part of the dementia, or is it a delirium, which is an acute kind of confusional state on top of the dementia in response to something that we could address, like an infection, a urinary tract infection, or an upper respiratory infection, a new medication, an over-the-counter pill that somebody has been giving them, a change in the home environment, maybe a new family member moved in or moved out.
So some pattern in the environment may have changed to, right, make someone more agitated, for example.
Sure.
How about things like wandering? Because I know that can really wreak havoc in the lives of families.
Not to mention pose a real risk to the person themselves, especially as weather, either side of the extreme of weather and the cold or the hot. Wandering is a real concern. People, I usually say people, you know, they don't wander until they do. it's something that should be on the radar, especially for people that are functionally independent and can walk around on their own. Getting lost in your own area and your own neighborhood definitely can happen to people. So there are some very reactive things that you could put in place, sort of insurance policies. There's a safe returns program through the Alzheimer's Association. It's a bracelet with some identifying information on it that could connect you back with your loved one. There's other options that have GPS trackers in them on the bracelet, so you can actually find the person as opposed to waiting for somebody passively. So those are some sort of preventive strategies, but it definitely is a concern. And as disease processes progress, that need for direct supervision really becomes more and more apparent, and that's when wandering becomes a concern.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen along with Dr. Andrea Berg, and we're talking about strategies for living with someone with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. So let's just overall, let's talk about some of the ADL type things, the activities of daily living. People who begin to have problems with things like incontinence, for example, who might not have had that prior to that, issues surrounding bathing, that kind of thing. What are some of the general tips or pointers that are important for people to know in terms of strategies?
Sure. Those are our issues. The incontinence issue is a really large one on caregivers in particular, especially people that are trying to support their loved one in their home. In the late stages of a disease, people typically are non-ambulatory, meaning they don't walk, and they're incontinent of both bowel and bladder. And that could have some real repercussions on somebody's ability to provide that level of care in their home. There's no magic pill to unfortunately take that away. The result of not being able to walk or to control one's bladder or bowel is really a problem of processing the connection between the brain and the other body parts. So we don't have a way to reverse that at this time. so often it's much more support. So sometimes you need more hands on deck. That one person really can't provide all that care at home. That's a very high level of care that sometimes people are trying to do all on their own.
How about things like diet and nutrition? Because I think along with the potential for apathy and isolation might be a disinterest in food. Mm-hmm. And obviously nutrition is crucial to life. So what kind of recommendations or what kind of tips or thoughts do you have around encouraging people to be able to continue to eat well?
So eating should still be a source of pleasure. It's one of those sort of primal, pleasurable activities. So I caution people to not get too hung up on the details or place any dietary restrictions on their loved one. If they want to eat ice cream in the later stages three times a day, go for it. And this isn't the time to really be super worried about, you know, diabetes or, you know, watching your salt or sugar. Keep eating pleasurable. So frequent meals. If feeding becomes an issue, as it does for people as the disease progresses, hand feeding. It doesn't have to be fast. Go slow. This could be a time, actually, a really positive interaction between a loved one and their caregiver. It's a way to care for somebody and show your love, to have a meal with somebody, not just provide food, but have the company as well, so that it's not just nutritional nourishment, but also social and physical contact.
How important is it when you're talking about, for example, bathing issues or cleanliness, to, 'cause I read somewhere that it's, people can be somewhat, if they were modest, for example, prior to their dementia, can find this whole thing of having to be bathed kind of in a way insulting. And so do you have any suggestions for then how to maybe handle that as well?
Right. I think that right there is probably the most important thing, is realizing how much of an intrusion and a change this is. Often there are other caregivers that are providing help as well. Sometimes people have home health aides or neighbors that are coming in and providing some help. So essentially you have strangers coming, and that could be seen as a violation.
Very true.
So recognizing that, I think, is will get you a long way than any sort of specifics, because it really is going to be how you approach a person and how you interact with them, that it's not avoiding just being task oriented, that the bathing has to get done and this needs to, but
recognizing the potential for trauma,
absolutely,
emotional trauma, mm-hmm. And I read somewhere something, even if you keep a towel covering a person's private areas until or if you need to actually address cleaning that area during some kind of a bathing, that there's more of a respect for the individual during
absolutely.
That time.
And breaking down what we're saying as well. And often we don't even think, we'll kind of hammer out multi-step instructions to somebody and not think about it because it might seem basic, but slowing down your words, separating the sentence into one part at a time, allowing somebody to complete the task and enough time that they need to take it to do so.
Those are really key points. Before, I don't want to run out of time. I want to get to this whole idea of the caregiver.
Sure.
Because part of what this is all about is the fact that there are people, as we mentioned, doing this very, very difficult work. They if it's a loved one, clearly it's a labor of love, but it's also very much of a strain on them. What recommendations do you offer to people who are in the midst of being a caregiver?
I think the biggest thing that we emphasize is that it's really not negotiable to take care of yourself. Often people will say that
you must do that.
Right. That they don't have time, or that they always come, they end up coming second. But rates of depression and anxiety and overall just poor health outcomes are pretty rampant in caregivers of patients or loved ones with dementia. So it's really not negotiable. If you're going, you have to maintain healthy, your own level of health, or else you're not going to be much help to those that you're trying to care for.
Which includes nutrition, adequate sleep.
Yeah, going to your own doctor appointments, certainly exercising, and taking time for yourself too. It's not selfish. It's actually necessary.
It's necessary. And how do people get a break? Let's talk a bit about respite.
Sure.
Because I don't want to run out of time. But.
Sure. So respite, I mean, it certainly could come in different forms, but respite is a concept that basically you're tagging out and that your loved one is going to be well cared for, either people coming into your home and giving you some time to take care of your own needs. There are other forms of respite where your loved one may go to another physical place. So that's something that's probably best directed for an individual to approach a social worker through, you know, either a clinic or Alzheimer's Association to see what your options are. But that concept,
or even the Office of Aging.
Absolutely. But that concept of respite is really invaluable for people to recharge their own battery, because caring for somebody with dementia, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And you really need to kind of time it appropriately to make your care sustainable.
Very good advice. Thank you so much. We could talk on and on and on about this, and I'm sure there are a lot of people out there very interested in this topic. Perhaps we'll have another opportunity to do so. But I want to thank you. My guest has been Dr. Andrea Berg. She's assistant professor of medicine and specializing in geriatrics at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, if you've been heard to say, "Oh, my aching back," you'll find out what you need to know. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, if you're like most people, you've often been heard to mutter the phrase, "Oh, my aching back," at least more than once in your life. Back pain is a very common complaint, and according to the Mayo Clinic, approximately 80% of all Americans will have low back pain at least once in their lives. Here with some of the common causes and treatments for this ailment is Adam Rufa, assistant professor in the College of Health Professions at Upstate Medical University and a doctor of physical therapy. Welcome, Dr. Rufa. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So back pain is really common, and from what I understand, it's a common reason for either absence from work as well as a visit to the doctor. But while it can be very painful, is it generally very serious?
Most of the time, back pain is a normal part of life. And as you stated, most people in their life are going to have back pain, 80, 90%. And the vast majority of time, it's nothing serious, and it'll go away with little to no treatment at all.
So when we talk about the source of the pain, let's help us understand, you know, whether it's the lower back or the upper back, what's causing the pain?
That's actually a surprisingly difficult question to answer. There's done a lot of research on trying to find what the major sources of low back pain are, and it's been really challenging. When they first came out with MRIs, everybody was excited because we could get a really good look at what was going on at the back. We could see the discs and we could see the muscles, and we started to find things and think that the disc herniation or that muscle strain was the problem. But then as we started to look at more individuals without low back pain, those same findings came up. So individuals had a high prevalence of disc herniations and degenerative changes. So it's
but
really
they did
been,
not have the pain.
Then they didn't have the pain. And it's been a real mystery what differentiates those people who maybe have a disc herniation and don't have pain from the person who has that disc herniation and does have pain. So it's really a complex question that we unfortunately haven't quite figured out yet.
So is there a distinction, though, between pain that occurs in the lower back versus the upper back in terms of potential causation?
There can be. And if you talk about the upper back, if we look way up by the shoulder blades in that area, that's a much less common place to get pain. And it's a much more stable area because we have our ribs all attaching and it keeps the back from moving quite as much. And so you have less, it's less common to have things like disc herniations and degenerative changes there. So
it could be more that it's muscle pain or pulling on some of the tendons. And in the low back, sometimes we have more findings of disc herniations and degenerative changes. But again, it's not always clear if those are what's causing the symptoms.
I think that's very interesting. So I think that's hence why so many people, when they have back pain or they contemplate treatments, and we'll get to that in a minute, it's a really hard decision to make because, as you said, we're not always sure about the one-to-one relationship between structural findings, abnormalities with regard to structural findings, versus whether they have pain or the degree to their pain, or whether changes in those structures through some manipulation or surgery will actually solve the problem.
Yeah, it's a real big challenge, and it's hard on our end as healthcare professionals because we like to be able to have somebody come in and examine them and have a really clear idea about what interventions are going to be most effective for this person and what their potential prognosis is. But it's very difficult to subcategorize people. So we end up looking at them very generally and just say people with low back pain. Or we might categorize it as a person with primarily back pain, so back-dominant pain, or primarily leg-dominant pain. And we might separate them there because some individuals will have lots of leg pain that's coming from something in their back. And so when we do that, we can get a little idea of prognosis, but what we found is that individuals who stay as active as they can and who really have a good attitude about their back pain and really just look at not letting it become take over their lives and just really kind of fight back and stay moving, do the best.
I want to talk about treatment, and prognosis. Prognosis meaning what will happen to them over time.
Yeah.
So what are the risk factors that are playing a role in terms of who, or are there? I mean, obviously you're saying that there's not a one-to-one ratio between structural changes or structural abnormalities and pain. So then, who are the people who are most likely to experience, in your experience, experience back pain? Obviously, we said 80% of the population, yeah. But what are the things that kind of lead to that?
So that's another great question, but it's another tough one. And, there's been lots of thoughts that maybe there's things like posture is a problem. And that made a lot of sense, that if you're in a certain posture, that maybe that puts extra strain and stress on the back, and that could be a problem. But when we've done studies on it, it's really found that individuals of all different types of posture have back pain. And it makes it very challenging because so many people have back pain.
So even people with so-called good posture might still have back pain.
Yeah, they have just as much back pain as people with that so-called bad posture.
How about things, and I found a laundry list of these kinds of things, admittedly on the internet, but how about things like depression or anxiety or smoking or obesity for that matter?
That's a great question. And if we look at back pain a little in two categories, as acute back pain and chronic back pain. So acute back pain is kind of the back pain that just happened. I might have woken up and my back sore and it goes away over a couple days. And that's the back pain that, as researchers, we're moving away from a little bit because we know that really is not what costs us a lot as a society and as individuals. That usually goes away, but a small percentage of those individuals will switch over to having what we call chronic pain. And this is pain that's lasting much longer than it should, given the injury that they've had. So it might be lasting for months or even years in some very rare cases. And what we've started to look at, away from these ideas that there's some kind of structural thing, is more some psychosocial factors that play a major role in somebody becoming or turning into having chronic pain. So things like you mentioned, depression. There's been several studies that have really connected depression as a big risk factor for developing chronic pain. There's also things like fear. There's this model called fear avoidance that we talk about. And some individuals get a great amount of fear when they have back pain, and then they start avoiding activity. And that ends up leading to more pain down the road and longer pain, where a person who doesn't have as much fear and just says, I'm going to keep moving, and not quite as worried about their pain, ends up doing better.
How about something like age, though? It seems like young children generally don't suffer from back pain. So would you agree that if you look at a so-called risk factor, that as we age, the chances are greater that we will experience some back pain. I mean, I don't know if teenagers, you know, have chronic back pain, for example.
You know, when they do studies, it's actually surprising how often kids have back pain as well.
Really?
But I think I do agree that it does seem to be more common as we get older. And the actual type of back pain that we get changes some as we age, and there's different categories that happen more often in people in different age groups.
So, as you mentioned, there are certain structural problems that we can point to, like a herniated disc or a ruptured disc, for that matter, as the source. But you're saying that it's not always a one-to-one.
It isn't. You know, we have to do what you call clinically correlate the symptoms. So if you take an MRI and you see a disc herniation, say at L5 on the right, and the person comes in and they have left-sided symptoms, well, that doesn't correlate very well to the finding. So it gives you a little more confidence that maybe that's not important. But if they do have right-sided pain, and if, say, that disc maybe is putting a little bit of irritation onto the L5 nerve root, well, that's a nerve root that goes down into your leg, and it feeds certain areas for sensation and strength. So then we can test you, and we can say if that particular area that L5 goes to is also weak and also has some numbness, that really helps us to pull together to say, all right, it makes sense that this disc herniation we're seeing on the MRI is causing these symptoms. It gives us more confidence in that.
So it really is kind of on a case-by-case basis,
yeah,
to really understand with what you're looking at. And actually, that's a great bridge for me into how you diagnose back pain. I mean, you've already alluded to things like an MRI. What are the types of modalities that are most commonly used today to determine what might be an underlying cause for back pain?
The vast majority of cases, if you look at most of the guidelines that are out there, and these are recommendations put out by professional organizations, the vast majority of people who have back pain do not need imaging. They don't need x-rays and they don't need MRIs. Unless there's something in their history or their physical exam that maybe suggests that there could be something more worrisome going on. But really, as far as diagnosing and classifying, it's about spending a lot of time talking with the patient and finding out about what's going on, and then doing a good physical exam and watching them move and looking at their strength and things like their reflexes and sensation if need be, and also putting them in categories of age as well can help figure out what are things that are most common. For instance, a person who's older, say in their over 60, have a lower chance of this being an acute disc herniation, because the discs are a little more dried up at that age, and they're not as prone to herniation, but they might be more apt to have what we call stenosis, which is a narrowing of the spaces where the nerves run, and that can sometimes cause some irritation on the nerve. So those kind of things all put together. And if somebody is having signs like a lot of numbness or weakness, or if they have what we call non-mechanical back pain, which is back pain that doesn't necessarily change when they move or in certain positions, those are usually people that we want to go and get imaging on sooner, because it could be indicating that there's something other than just the normal back pain that's going on.
Perhaps something like a tumor, perhaps, or
yeah,
something
like
that.
Yeah, that can happen. It's rare, but that can occur.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with physical therapist Dr. Adam Rufa. We're talking about back pain and what to do about it. Jesus, so much to talk about. Would you think, or do we have access to something like an MRI that can watch motion? It always struck me that when you're taking still images about a functional problem, that you're really more at risk to making wrong assumptions. Is that in the future? Does it exist currently that somebody could be actually imaging someone in motion to determine that functionality?
We do. There is some technology out there that's been mostly used on a research basis and less in a clinical setting. There are x-ray technologies that allow us to look at some motion while they're doing it. But with MRI and CT scan, it's a little more difficult. And there is some technology out there, but really just in the research setting, and it's pretty expensive.
Would you think that might be a help down the road?
It may be. It may be. We'll have to see where, as we get more research, it does seem to be that we're moving a little bit away from this structural thoughts. And we've spent a lot of time and a lot of money going down that route with research, and it really hasn't turned out a lot of great information. But it is exciting to think about looking at these things differently, because it'd be really helpful if we could find something like that that gave us some insight. And even as simply as now MRIs, people tend to have them laying down. And you think about it, the pressures on our back are much different when we're laying down than when we're standing.
Absolutely.
So I think even the first step might be starting to get MRI machines and other and CT machines that allow us to take some images standing up, which are out there, but more in a research capacity.
Very interesting. So very quickly, again, I don't want to run out of time. Who's best able then to diagnose back pain, given what you said? I mean, are we looking at an orthopod, or are we looking at a chiropractor, are we looking at an osteopath, or a doctor of physical therapy?
I don't know that there's one particular profession that owns this low back pain. There's been a lot of evidence out there coming recently that the sooner you get into care by a physical therapist, and I'm a little biased, that people end up doing better. We spend less money overall, and recovery happens faster. So I'm a big proponent to getting to a good physical therapist as soon as you can. And it might be the first person you see, or it might be after you go to a physician. But yeah, chiropractors are in, orthopedic surgeons. I think though most of the time, you don't need to see an orthopedic surgeon right off. Most people do not need surgery for low back pain, and that's what they're really good at. They're really good at doing surgery. So a lot of times, staying more conservative with your general practitioner or a physical therapist or a chiropractor or something like that, I think is the way to go initially.
And as you said, I so much to talk about and so little time right now, but you basically want to treat acute differently than chronic. Very briefly, acute, what do you generally do?
Acute is all about as little rest as you need to take. So you want to go easy to a certain degree, but you also don't want to stop. You want to stay as active as possible. And with chronic, sometimes people need a little more help. And a lot of times it's good to get a multidisciplinary approach where you have people who maybe a pain specialist who are looking at different medications, maybe even getting a psychologist or a psychiatrist involved to help deal with a lot of the psychosocial things that occur when you're in chronic pain. And it's this kind of chicken and egg thing that people who have things like depression are more likely to have chronic pain. But also once you have chronic pain,
it can lead.
Yeah, it's really hard to deal with all those
so
things.
So even things like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy could be of help. Psychotherapy could be of help. Surgery, you're saying, is not often of help, and there's this whole failed back syndrome that you have to worry about. Just briefly in the end, so what, just give us your, kind of overarching principle then in terms of what to do if you have, let's say, chronic back pain, because acute sounds to me is something that you want to kind of just maybe even wait out, but stay moving.
Yeah, and I think chronic pain is very similar in that really try to switch the mentality to letting the pain control you.
From the letting patient, it control
yeah,
you.
So don't let the pain control you. You start controlling the pain. And really staying active and taking a very active approach to the treatment is important. And it really is very different for each individual, but taking a positive attitude and staying in exercising as much as possible, I think, are the keys.
So the help of a physician, perhaps with medications, and at the same time, a physical therapist can really help move you through these different stages.
Yes.
Fabulous. Thank you so very much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Adam Ruffa. He's assistant professor in the College of Health Professions at Upstate Medical University and a doctor of physical therapy. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Sarah Hughes is a professor at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia. Her lovely poem, Lullaby, both celebrates and eulogizes a mother's love and legacy. Lullaby. The crickets are singing your name, my mother would whisper low. Let go of your guilt and blame. Come morning, the poppies will glow. My mother would whisper low, the sun will heal all regret. Come morning, the poppies will glow, and fields will tremble with sweat. The sun will heal all regret, like a mother bathing her offspring, and fields will tremble with sweat. But now the darkness is cooing, like a mother bathing her offspring. Life may be nothing but darkness, but now that darkness is cooing. There may be no mystery beyond this. There may be nothing but darkness. Sometimes a dirt road just ends. There may be no mystery beyond us. It's okay to cry, my friends. Sometimes a dirt road just ends with no warning beneath a barren moon. It's okay to cry, my friends. We all lose our mothers too soon. With no warning beneath a barren moon, we begin our late night weeping. We all lose our mothers too soon. Listen, even the wind and leaves have begun their late night weeping. Let go of your guilt and blame. Listen, O wind and leaves, the crickets are singing our names.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore the role of genetics in rare diseases. Plus, we examine all the newest recommended adult immunizations and the controversy surrounding the new USDA food guidelines. If you'd like to listen again to this week's show, you can find a podcast of it on iTunes. Just search for HealthLink On Air. That's all one word. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or check up the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.